From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
It was the tyranny of a single decision in a single chaotic night.
Arguments over the occult and opioid addiction today at Suffolk Superior Court as lawyers make their opening statements in the Bella Bond murder case. Also today...
It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in that region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran.
But Andrew Bacevich says that's the kind of rhetoric that will make the fight against terrorism last forever, not end it. And a Newton mother of three becomes a surrogate twice for her married gay friends.
Sometimes I'll forget that I'm pregnant. And I think a big piece of that is because it's not mine.
Plus, the vast and wonderful world of cheese.
Now, my good man, some cheese, please.
Yes, certainly, sir. What would you like?
Well, how about a little Red Leicester?
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Opening statements today in the murder case of Bella Bond. She's the 2-year-old whose body was found on Deer Island, stuffed in a plastic garbage bag in 2015. The child's mother, Rochelle Bond, agreed to a plea deal in exchange for her testimony against her boyfriend, Michael McCarthy. He faces first-degree murder charges. Suffolk County Assistant DA David Deacon said in opening statements today that McCarthy was obsessed with the occult and that Bond found him hitting the toddler on the night she died.
When she asked him, what did you do? He said, she just died. It was her time. She was a demon.
Defense attorney Jonathan Shapiro cast McCarthy as a caring man who had a purely scholarly interest in good and evil.
According to the prosecutor, this obsession gave Michael a motive to kill Bella, that he killed her because he believed she was a demon. That is absurd.
Well, we're joined now by Susan Zellkind. She's an investigative reporter covering the trial for The Daily Beast. She was at Suffolk Superior Court, but she joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what are your first impressions of day one of this trial and the opening arguments? What was the mood like in the courtroom?
Well, I've been to a lot of murder trials, and this one really sticks to you. I think part of the reason is the victim, who's a 2-year-old girl. I don't think you can say that any other victim could be more innocent than Bella Bond. But part of it is the uncertainty. You have the witness, who's the girl's mother, Rochelle Bond, who was in the apartment where her daughter was held in a refrigerator for a number of weeks and then accompanied the alleged murderer to South Boston, where they dumped it into the ocean. And then the other factor is that you have demonology.
Right.
The supernatural plays a real role in this trial.
So tell us more about that, because in the days and weeks after Bella Bond's body was identified and Rochelle Bond and Michael McCarthy were brought to public's attention, we got a first hint of that the occult may play a role here, but we heard it firsthand in the trial today. I mean, what more did prosecutors and defense attorneys say about that?
Well, you have the prosecution on the one hand is trying to paint McCarthy as someone who's very interested in demonology, who it all started with sage. He came to Rochelle Bond's apartment and started using sage to cast out an evil spirit that she said she felt too. Then it seemingly escalated. And we've heard this before leading up to the trial, that there's a witness who allegedly was in the apartment and was there when Bella Bond was locked in a closet because her caregivers thought she was a demon, who thought she was possessed. Now, on the other hand, you have the defense who says, no, it's not Michael McCarthy who's obsessed with demons. It's Rochelle Bond, who's the mother and the key witness. And her story, according to the defense, and this is the real spooky part that we heard today, she says a friend says that she told her that a shadow has been following her whole life and the demons had tried to get to her, but she was too strong. And now the demons are trying to get to her through her daughter.
Hmm. Interesting. And of course, as you said, Rochelle Bond's going to be testifying against Michael McCarthy. That was part of her plea deal. So she's the star witness for the prosecution. And in fact, was the only person there in the house on the night that, other than McCarthy, on the night that Bella Bond was killed. But also, let me ask you, we heard an entirely different portrayal of McCarthy from his defense attorney, from Jonathan Shapiro. I mean, you were there, and I was reading things on Twitter about Shapiro saying things like, you know, McCarthy was actually very loving to Bella Bond.
Yeah, you heard that. You hear another side of McCarthy. You hear about Catholic school. You hear about heroin, and heroin is another huge factor in this entire trial, addiction and opioids. But you also hear that when McCarthy came to the family, that he was able to better take care of Bella, that he was the reason why he was in the house was because he was able to put her to bed. He was a stern, loving authority figure, and that we'll see more of that in the trial.
Mm. Well, you mentioned drugs and drug abuse being a major part of this trial. Let's play a little bit more tape. This is Suffolk County Assistant DA David Deacon, and he said one of the things that makes this trial quite difficult is that addicts in general, he said, often have a hard time remembering specific, like, times, dates, and places.
One of the things that you will experience in this case is that the evidence will show you that most of the major players in this case had damaged themselves with drugs. Some of them almost literally hollowing themselves out with substances.
Susan, so let me ask you a very important point, because if I remember correctly, both Rochelle Bond and Michael McCarthy were quite significant drug users. But why would the assistant DA make this point when Rochelle Bond is going to be the star witness for the prosecution? Doesn't this also sort of make jurors wonder, can we trust what she says?
I think he's playing defense here. There's a lot of problems with Rochelle Bond's testimony. One of the biggest problems with this case is that there is no clear cause of death. We don't know exactly how Bella was murdered. So the government's case, to a large degree, is going to rest on what Rochelle Bond says. Now, by the prosecution's own account, Rochelle Bond is a heroin addict. The prosecution claims that after Michael McCarthy murdered Bella, that he injected Rochelle Bond with heroin into her neck and induced her addiction once more. The defense is going to say that she was already an addict. But we also see, when we're hearing these stories about witnesses in the trial that we're going to hear about later, running into each other in Methadone Mile. Mm. Rochelle Bond runs into the father of her child, who's never met Bella. There's another witness who Rochelle Bond tells a story to, who's a friend of McCarthy, who she also sees on Methadone Mile. So we see addiction in every single aspect of this case.
Right. And I think that's one of the things, one of the reasons why this case so thoroughly caught the nation's attention in 2015, because we have the scourge of drugs. We have two very troubled people at the heart of it. We have a murdered two-year-old. We also have the failure of the state at times in terms of the Bond's interaction with DCF and, you know, how the neighborhood responded. I mean, why do you think this case, now that we're in the actual trial portion, continues to to captivate not just Massachusetts residents, but also the country?
Well, I mean, at first you have a dead child who went unidentified for months. So the idea that somebody or nobody could be missing this child, I think, haunted the world in many ways. And I think it still does. So what's the story now? Why didn't anybody step forward earlier? And we're seeing a large part of that story has to do with drugs. And are we as a community responsible for that? What could DCF have done differently? I know Governor Baker made a huge report after this finding. Mm. I think it's still haunting, but it's also still really unresolved.
Yeah.
This, I think the prosecution is going to have to work hard to convince the jury that Michael McCarthy is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt based on Rochelle Bond's testimony.
Well, Susan Zellkind is a journalist for The Daily Beast. She's covering the murder trial, the trial of the murder of Bella Bond that's going on now at Suffolk Superior Court. Opening arguments were heard there today. Susan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
turn now to U.S. foreign policy. Andrew Bacevich, professor emeritus of history and international relations at Boston University, writes in the Boston Globe that during President Trump's first overseas trip last week, Trump, quote, simultaneously affirmed and recast the war on terrorism. And in doing so, he almost guarantees its continuation in perpetuity. Well, that recasting of the war on terror can be heard in Trump's speech to the Arab Islamic American Summit in Riyadh last week.
But no discussion of stamping out this threat would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three: safe harbor, financial backing, and the social standing needed for recruitment. It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in that region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran.
Well, Andrew Bacevich joins us now. Professor Bacevich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much.
So, first of all, by focusing on Iran, how exactly is President Trump recasting the war on terror?
Well, let's rerun the videotape here. Go back to 2001, when the main target of the war on terror was al-Qaeda. The George W. Bush administration then rather quickly fingered Saddam Hussein's Iraq as the sponsor, supporter, auxiliary, and so we went about invading Iraq because that was going to solve the problem. Here we are all these years later, and now our current president says that all along, apparently, Iran has been the villain, and Iran now becomes the principal target of this ongoing enterprise.
But Professor, I mean, if I may, and I'm sad to say it's been so many years, I'm not 100% sure I remember this correctly, but I mean, wasn't Iran always part of the mix with the Axis of Evil, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, when George W. Bush was trying to provide a larger frame looking beyond Iraq, he did say that we were up against this Axis of Evil, which included not only Iran, but also, for whatever bizarre reasons, North Korea. As a practical matter, however, the focus of attention was primarily, for George W. Bush, was primarily on Iraq and to a lesser degree on Afghanistan, since that's where the al-Qaeda conspiracy was concocted in the first place. There was no war against Iran at that junction.
I see. So the distinction you're making is a more militaristic language from President Trump specifically regarding Iran than we've heard before. Because you know, I was thinking back, and I honestly can't remember a time from President Reagan on forward where Iran hasn't been the target of some kind of bellicose U.S. rhetoric, though.
Well, I mean, I think actually that was changing in the second term of the Barack Obama administration. Remember that, I think in many respects, Obama's principal foreign policy achievement was the successful negotiation of the nuclear weapons deal with Iran, which in exchange for some economic concessions led to Iran's commitment not to develop nuclear weapons. I'm in the camp that believed that opening had the potential to lead to a broader engagement with Iran, and that in the best case, that broader engagement could actually lead to some sort of restabilization of the region. Hmm. What we now hear from the current president, although he's not going to, it appears that he's not going to abrogate the Iran nuclear deal, what we're now hearing from him is clear signals he has no intention of using that as an opportunity to lead to any further engagement. On the contrary, he's identifying Iran as our principal adversary, very much pleasing Saudi Arabia and Israel by making that statement.
Right. So about the Saudis and Israel, I want to get back to that in just a second. But in your op-ed, you write that in blaming Iran for terrorism, that President Trump is essentially ignoring the root problem here. But I was looking back at, you know, a June 2016 State Department report that identified Iran as the number one state sponsor of terror. So I wonder, I mean, perhaps the president isn't too far off on the mark here, because Can't U.S. foreign policy be seen as an effective way, or the tools of U.S. foreign policy be seen as an effective way to diminish the role of state-sponsored terrorism, whereas conventional policy tools that we have perhaps are not as effective as at getting to those root causes of terrorism, which may have more to do with religion and sectarian conflict, and as you know better than anyone else, a century of dark history in the Middle East that the United States is a major part of.
Yeah, I think it is fair. I take the point that you are making is that there is this thing called root causes that may or may not be responsive to military action, but there are terrorist actions, terrorist conspiracies where military action may be necessary, at least in the interim. But what I would say is, regardless of what the State Department says about Iran being the principal sources of terror, they're sure not the only ones. And indeed, if we're looking for states that sponsor terrorism, it's important, I think, to look at states like Saudi Arabia, where there is an abundance of evidence that Saudi Arabia has been a supporter, a promoter of a intolerant form of Islam that serves as a breeding ground for jihadism and jihadist violence.
Right. Let me jump in here, Professor Amin, because I think this is an extraordinarily important point. I mean, why do you think that not just Donald Trump, but I would say even Barack Obama, George W. Bush, no recent president that I can remember has explicitly criticized the Saudi royal family for being the number one exporters and supporters, financially and otherwise, of radical Wahhabism around the world?
Well, great question. I don't believe I have an adequate answer. I think that there are multiple factors involved. One of them is a U.S.-Saudi relationship dating back to World War II, which may well have served U.S. interests during the Cold War, and which the political establishment or the national security establishment in Washington is somehow unwilling to reexamine and revisit, notwithstanding the fact that so much has changed since that relationship was forged. When that relationship was forged, it was because there was an appreciation in Washington of the importance of oil, of the importance of the oil in Saudi Arabia. There was an anticipation that the United States would become increasingly dependent upon foreign oil. All that was true in the near term. It's not true today. So we live in a world today where, whether for good or for ill, our way of life is still dependent upon having access to cheap gasoline, to overstate it slightly. But we don't need to get that gasoline from Saudi Arabia. So there is this reluctance, I think, to revisit some of the assumptions that underwrote the U.S.-Saudi relationship in the first place. And, of course, you have to also throw into the mix Israeli concerns, and the way that plays in our domestic politics.
Yeah. You know, in your op-ed, you even go a step further, and you write clearly that you think there's another player here, and that's the military-industrial complex, right? You say follow the money.
Well, it's because I don't find the strategic argument for this aligning ourselves with the Saudis and targeting Iran. I don't find the strategic argument persuasive. And therefore, you say, well, what else is going on? And what else? One of the other things is going on that was really one of the headlines of the president's visit to Saudi Arabia is a massive increase in Saudi weapons purchases from the United States. $100 billion, more than $100 billion, potential for three times that over the course of a decade. And I don't for a second believe that the military-industrial complex somehow controls U.S. foreign policy. I do believe it influences foreign policy, and I think we see that influence quite clearly as one of the factors that is shaping the Trump administration's policies toward that part of the world.
Could there be some strategic benefit to having a president who speaks about Iran in more muscular tones? I mean, could the rhetoric, I mean, I hope this doesn't sound naive, but could the rhetoric actually lead to some form of better ability, containment with Iran, containment of Iran, if, you know, they're looking at the United States as a stronger player?
I suppose that is possible, and I guess one of the reasons why I don't find that argument persuasive is that my own reading of the situation is somewhat different. I mean, my reading of Saudi Arabia is that it is a backward autocracy. There is very little, at least that I can see, going on within Saudi Arabia to suggest that it is on the road to reform and liberalization. And yet, when you look at what's happening in Iran, which just reelected by a substantial majority a moderate reformist president, contrast that with no elections that have ever happened in Saudi Arabia of any significance. When you look at the compelling evidence that the youthful cohort in Iran wishes to embrace secular modernity, that's a country, it seems to me, that does show very significant potential for liberalizing reform that can bring Iran more closely into alignment with our interests and our values.
Right.
And I think that's something that a far-sighted approach to statecraft would wish to explore, to test, to promote. And I think that what the Trump administration is doing is simply foreclosing that possibility. I think that's a mistake.
Professor Bacevich, one last question here, because regarding that, you know, $110+ billion arms deal that the president signed with Saudi Arabia, the closing paragraph of your op-ed actually brought to mind a 1951 speech, I believe, or 1953 speech given by Dwight Eisenhower, the Chance for Peace speech, and we just wanted to play a clip of it.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
You wrote in your op-ed, in the months ahead, Americans on food stamps or enrolled in Medicaid may have to tighten their belts. The military-industrial complex, along with its network of clients and auxiliaries, will do just fine. I mean, is what you're writing the same choice that Eisenhower said America or the world was making back in the early 1950s?
I think to some degree. May I say, I didn't know you were going to play that tape, and I just find it incredibly moving. It's unimaginable to have a president say something like that today. And this is a president who was a five-star general. I mean, frankly, I'm grateful to you that you dug that up, because I think that it is enormously pertinent to the present moment. And it provides another reason for us to worry about the direction that this administration is taking the country.
Well, since you said that, Professor Bacevich, I'm going to have my crack team here put a link to President Eisenhower's speech on our website, radioboston.org. And listeners, if you go there, you'll get a link to Andrew Bacevich's op-ed as well. He's Professor Emeritus of History of International Relations at Boston University. Professor Bacevich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Former FBI Director Robert Mueller was in Marion, Massachusetts yesterday. He delivered the graduation speech at Tabor Academy. Mueller, of course, was recently appointed as special counsel by the Department of Justice to investigate possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. Mueller was introduced at Tabor by his granddaughter, Campbell Donnelly, a Tabor graduating senior. She listed off his accomplishments: Marine Corps, Vietnam service, U.S. attorney in Boston, former FBI director. And Donnelly also mentioned lessons her grandfather had taught her.
Above all, he has taught me the true meaning of humility. And just to illustrate that, I have honestly learned more about his life successes from this brief bio than from anything he's told me directly about his own accomplishments.
Well, given that, it won't come as any surprise that Mueller made absolutely no mention of Trump yesterday. The former FBI director is famously tight-lipped, more so now that he's handling the most politically sensitive investigation in America. But his granddaughter did make some news. We now know that Robert Mueller has a nickname.
He is also my grandfather, who I fondly call Bubba.
Well, as I mentioned, Mueller himself didn't make any news in his Tabor speech yesterday, but he did provide some insight into values he says have guided his own career: service, patience, humility, and integrity.
When given the opportunity to address students, I always mention integrity because it is so essential to who and what you ultimately will become. Many of you may have a career path in mind. Many of you have no idea where you will end up. A few of you may be surprised by where life takes you. I certainly was. And in the end, it is not only what we do, but how we do it. Whatever we do, we must act with honesty and with integrity. And regardless of your chosen career, you're only as good as your word. You can be smart, aggressive, articulate, indeed persuasive, but if you are not honest, your reputation will suffer, and once lost, a good reputation can never, ever be regained. As the saying goes, if you have integrity, nothing else matters, and if you do not have integrity, nothing else matters.
Robert Mueller, speaking at Tabor Academy in Marion, Massachusetts yesterday. By the way, Mueller also noted that there comes a time when every person is tested and may even have to stand alone against trusted colleagues. So he encouraged students to remember their school's own adage, truth always conquers. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. What might compel a Newton woman in her 40s who already has three teenage children of her own to become a surrogate? And not just once, but twice within 2 years. Well, that question drives the new documentary, The Guys Next Door. The film follows what the directors called a real modern family. And that group includes Rachel, the surrogate, her family, and the gay married couple she helps conceived, one of whom who's been a friend since college. Now, the filmmaker followed this family for 3 years, and their documentary offers an intimate reflection on parenthood and the question of nature versus nurture. Well, joining us now in the studio is Rachel Segal. She is the surrogate who is one of the primary subjects of the new documentary. Rachel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us are the film's co-directors and co-producers, Amy Geller and Ali Humanuk. Welcome to both of you as well.
Thanks so much for having us.
Okay, so first of all, Ali and Amy, let me just get to you. You dubbed this family a real modern family. What was it about this story, about Rachel's story, that made you want to make a film out of it?
Well, I read this article in a magazine, and I was just, how you started this is exactly how I felt. What would compel a woman in her 40s to do this for her gay friends? Not once, but twice in 17 months. I was just completely blown away by this question, and I had to get to the answer. And I'm a documentary filmmaker, so I reached out to Ali, and she's an amazing cinematographer, and we reached out to Rachel. We had mutual friends in common, and we started on this journey of making this film. And Ali likes to jump in here.
what happened in my mind is Amy came to me and said, I've never really directed a documentary before. Will you co-direct and co-produce with me? What I heard her saying was a film about surrogacy. And so I just said, no, you know, I'm sorry. I really like you. I'll be happy to shoot some footage and help you get enough to cut a trailer and raise some money. But so I agreed to go, and we met the whole family. We started filming. And then after filming for a day, I looked at Amy and I was like, Amy, if you want to jump off a cliff with me and go on a journey with his family and start filming and we'll have no idea where we're going, but we feel like there's something rich here, then I'm all in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it turns out that Amy wasn't saying a film about surrogacy.
No,
but
I wasn't.
Yeah. Well, Rachel, since you are here, let's just jump straight to that question that we've asked already a couple of times. I mean, being a surrogate twice in less than 2 years, why'd you want to do it?
Well, I think that just for me, being a mother, being a parent has been so important. And my husband, Tony, is incredibly loving and supportive. And I just felt that we were so lucky that we could so easily create our own family. And just thinking about how hard it is for gay couples, especially men, to be able to just conceive, you know, and be able to have their own biological children if they want to. It just felt unfair. Mm-hmm. And Eric is somebody that I had known since college, and Tony and I both know him and love him, and he's just a terrific guy. And then when we met Sandro, his partner, I mean, to meet Sandro is to fall in love with him. Yeah. So they just both are wonderful, and it just felt really important to help them.
Let me just jump in here, because I've got... I will preface this next question with full disclosure. I had my second child when I was 38, like a month short of 39. Okay. It was a lot harder the second time around because I was older. And you did these two surrogacies when you were even older than that.
Yes.
Right.
I mean,
were you concerned ever about the risks to yourself? Because I mean, look, it's not easy being pregnant no matter what age you are, right?
You know, I'm really, really lucky. I've had a really easy time with pregnancy and deliveries. And so I wasn't worried. My mother was a little concerned.
Well, so to that point, I actually want to play a piece of tape from the documentary. It's this clip of Tony, your husband.
Yes.
And he actually talked to you guys quite honestly about concerns that his family had
His
mother had to the gift that you were giving to, you know, your two friends.
I still am, at least in name, Roman Catholic. So come from a pretty conservative upbringing. My father clearly doesn't agree with some of the choices that I've made in life. My mom reacted to it as almost feeling like it was a selfish thing. You know, you're jeopardizing the health of your children's mother.
So that was Tony there saying that his mother was concerned that your health was being jeopardized, and you're a mother already to your own kids. I mean, how did you handle that concern? Because this is a story about a big, larger that family we talked about mm-hmm. earlier, which included his mother, I presume.
Well, she does live in Hawaii, so
okay, it's like it's
we didn't have to worry about that too much, and. So, yes, I mean, I did have to be aware of other people's feelings, particularly my parents, who I'm pretty close with. They were concerned at times about my health, but I think I just knew myself really well. I knew that I could do it, I guess, and I just didn't feel concerned, and things went really smoothly. And as I said, I'm just incredibly, incredibly lucky that I do have such an easy time.
Yeah. Well, Ali and Amy, I mean, as filmmakers, you brought these stories, you know, into the movie, into the documentary overall. Talk to me about the complications that other people around, you know, outside of Rachel and her immediate family felt.
Do you want to take that? What's interesting is there haven't been that many complications. Mm. And so that was one of the biggest challenges in making the film, because there's not a lot at stake in some ways. The biggest thing at stake at times was, you know, how your families felt about what you were doing. But we put together this story where Rachel's doing this incredible thing for her friends, and her friends are great parents, and you know, it all kind of goes well. And that's because of where we live. But I think that what's interesting is you see this film and you often come out feeling good about it. And we found that this is in some ways a great piece of advocacy, because you go on this journey, you come out, you feel good, and then you're like, wait a minute, that was a gay family, or this woman just gave them children through surrogacy. So we're feeling like, I don't know, that now it's actually a a film that's taking on greater meaning than we thought before Trump became president.
Oh, interesting. So tell me more about that.
And I also think, just to add to that, there is drama in the film, but the drama is more about sort of people's experiences and people's emotional lives. And so Eric, for example, talks about sort of his internalized homophobia. And I think, you know, we live in a time and in a place where we sort of forget in some ways that these issues still exist. And, you know, he's in his mid-40s. He has this amazing family. He's married to this amazing man. He has these two wonderful children. And yet these are issues he still deals with. So I think that even, you know, living in Portland, Maine, where they live, and even though, you know, Rachel is in Newton, this story still resonates even within the communities we live in. Mm-hmm. So I think it's relevant both, you know, outside of in the larger world and also in the communities that we're showing it in.
Yeah. So another issue that's really brought forth in the film is this question of nature versus nurture. And I mean, Rachel, one of the things that you mentioned is the tension of, you know, which is the more powerful force in the raising of any child, mm-hmm. right? And if I remember correctly, you say that before you became a parent yourself, you thought that everything was just nurture, but maybe after having kids, you feel a little differently about that?
Yeah. I hope. I think that...
That's every parent's way of saying it's not my fault.
Exactly. But you also can't, you know, take all of their successes as yours either, then. But I think, for me, I just feel like I've gotten clearer and clearer as my children have gotten older, seeing how much it is a combination of nature and nurture and how genetics really do play a bigger role than... I think I realized anyway before I had children.
Yeah. So in the case of these two little girls, what is the genetic mix here for them?
We actually don't know the genetic mix. The guys decided that what happened is they each fertilized some eggs. And so when eggs were put into Rachel,
These are donor
eggs. Mm-hmm. And so one time, you know, two of the eggs had been fertilized by Sandro, one had been fertilized by Eric, so whatever. They don't know when the girls are born genetically who the father is.
It wasn't important to them, actually.
They didn't want it to be like, oh, I'm your father and I'm not your father. And they didn't want to know something the girls didn't know. So they did blood tests. The information is in a sealed envelope. And when the girls say, who is my genetic father, then they'll open the envelope and they'll find out together.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder, Rachel, what does that mean for the kind of relationship that you have or that you want to have with these two little girls?
Well, I guess the way we really view it is as if Eric and Sandro are like my brothers. And so I really see the kids as, you know, nieces or, you know, relatives in that way. And I know that my kids really view them as their younger cousins. And so it's really... this broader sense of what family can be. And, you know, my daughter Maddie actually coined the term womb mates, W-O-M-B.
Do the little girls know, or is it important for you, for them to know that you're...
Oh, they totally know.
Okay.
Yeah. We see them a lot. Okay. We're really close. And so we see each other every month or two generally. And they absolutely know that I carry them.
Did they ever ask, like, how does that work? Because, I mean, I know my kids are, like, obsessed with their birth stories. And I think kids frequently are because they just want to know where they came from.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
I mean, do the girls ever ask?
I think that they just know. I'm not sure exactly what the guys have told them. But I know that they know that I carried them and that they were in the same womb as Maddie, Jordy, and Zeke,
my
kids.
They also see it. And, you know, the kids have seen the film
several
times.
Right, the documentary exists, right, of course.
And the youngest one has said, I'm about to be born now. And so they call it their film. So it's really interesting. I mean, I don't know how many of us have seen our own birth.
Maybe more so now than a couple of years ago,
probably,
with more cameras in labor rooms than we've had before. But last question actually to you, Amy and Ellie. I mean, the documentary ends in the winter of 2015 or thereabouts. So, yep. I mean, how are things going now with this crazy modern complex family overall?
They continue to, you know, see each other on a regular basis. We, I think, have become part of the family. We, the filmmakers, mm-hmm. are now, they used to call us our filmmakers. Now I think they call us their friends. So yeah,
the girls or the guys?
Everybody.
Everybody.
I think everybody does. So I feel like it's been an incredible gift, and they've given us enormous trust. And they're an incredibly lovable family, and it's a really special film. So I hope people come and see it.
Yeah. Well, Amy Geller and Ali Humanuk are co-creators of the documentary The Guys Next Door. Amy and Ali, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Rachel Segal, she is one of the subjects of the documentary, and she's been a surrogate twice for her friends Eric and Sandro. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And I should say that the film is having a special screening this Sunday at the Coolidge Corner Theater and you can find more information about that at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Gorgonzola, yeah. Parmesan, yeah. Mozzarella, yeah. Pippo creme, yeah. Any Danish Finbo,
yeah.
Czechoslovakian sheep's milk cheese,
yeah.
Venezuelan beaver cheese.
Not today, sir, no.
It's a Monty Python cheese shop sketch, of course, where a customer attempts to purchase cheese from Ye Old Cheese Emporium. A cheese shop that has no cheese in stock whatsoever. But in her new book, The Oxford Companion to Cheese, University of Vermont professor Catherine Donnelly goes through the hundreds of cheeses that do exist around the world. And she's brought them all together again in The Oxford Companion to Cheese. And she joins us now from Colchester, Vermont. Professor Donnelly, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
This is the segment I have been looking forward to all day. Because I love cheese. But first of all, tell us, how many varieties of cheese do exist in the world?
It's estimated there are about 1,400 very diverse types that we enjoy globally.
1,400. And how many of them are in the Oxford Companion?
I think we have 255. Of course, we couldn't do an entry on all 1,400 because it would be volumes of books. So we had to be a little selective.
Well, I mean, actually, one can always hope, right? You could have volumes of books on cheese. What made you want to do this project?
Well, at the University of Vermont for many years, we had run an artisan cheese institute where we taught artisan cheesemakers how to safely produce cheese and the technologies that had been used for years in Europe. We invited a lot of European colleagues to teach classes for us. And so when the opportunity to be involved in this project came about, I thought it would be a lot of fun.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, part of the reason why I was looking forward to this segment is our producers here. They are such a great team. They brought cheese into the studio.
Yay.
But you're in Vermont, so you don't see what I've have in front of me. I have.
I can smell them.
You can, some of them, right? We have a Winamere, a raw cow's milk cheese with a washed rind. A Roquefort, maybe that's the one you can smell. Delicious. Humboldt Fog, goat's milk from California. And a Gruyere, raw cow's milk cheese. What's your favorite kind of cheese?
Well, you know, it's like asking what your favorite child is. I have so many favorites, but I have to say you've got a lineup that includes some of my very favorites.
Such as pick one.
Well, Winamere, I think, is a fantastic cheese. I'm a little biased because it's made in Greensboro, Vermont, which is about an hour away from the studio. And it is a cheese made in the tradition of a French cheese called Vacheron Montdor. And the idea that we can take that technology and replicate it here in Vermont and enjoy this absolutely stunning cheese that really is a living food and is so beautifully crafted, wrapped in spruce bark. It's a delicious cheese.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just the way you talk about cheese it's both scientific and informed and rhapsodic at times. And that feeling is really echoed in the book. I mean, you write, I'm just going to read a little paragraph here. You write, I can think of few other places in nature where microorganisms are more magnificently displayed than when associated with cheese. The blooms, the veins, the sticky surfaces, the gooey interiors, crystals, wrinkles, strings, and smells are all due to microbial action. So, I mean, to me, that's one of, honestly, that's one of the greatest things about it is that we wouldn't have cheese if it weren't for other organisms.
Well, exactly. And I'm a food microbiologist by training. And so, of course, I'm fascinated with the microbial activity. But absolutely, and I think what makes cheese and studying cheese so interesting is many of the varieties, like Roquefort, that's been made for 700 years. And so we didn't understand microbiology back in those days, but learned how to harness those beneficial organisms and put them to work for us.
Yeah. Now, you know, cheese is such an ancient food. And for most of the history of cheese, I think it's safe to say it was made with raw milk, right?
Absolutely. That is the cheese in its purest form, and also a repository for all of these indigenous cultures that we manipulate to make an appearance and make these cheeses so different in nature. But yes, it all starts with the raw milk and the associated organisms.
Yeah. Because in the course of preparing for this this segment today, I was talking with my producer, Caitlin, and we remembered an episode of a Michael Pollan documentary called Cooked, which you actually appeared in.
I did.
Yeah. And there was a scene where Michael Pollan visited a nun, Mother Noella, who makes a raw milk cheese in a wooden barrel. But she had to sort of change her manufacturing technique for a while because the health authorities said that she could spread listeria. But it turns out that didn't happen. And you said that Pollan had what you called a conversion experience when it came to raw milk cheeses?
Right. Well, I think visiting the Abbey of Regina Laudis, and Mother Noella is a good friend of mine, she's making a Senecterre cheese that's traditionally made in a wooden vat, and the source of organisms that inoculate the milk, they actually reside in the wood. And she turned to published studies to show Connecticut health inspectors that, in fact, you get more acidification, which helps make the cheese safe, when you're using the wooden vat versus a stainless steel vat. And they were very compelled by her science and let her carry on.
Hmm. She's a delightful person in that documentary, by
the way. And in person, she's a dear.
I just wanted to try her cheese at the end of it. But so, you know, in talking about cheese, I think it's very easy for us to maybe inadvertently focus on the typically famous cheese-producing regions of the world, right? I mean, there's all sorts of places in Europe. Vermont, right up there as well.
Vermont.
As well now. But in the Oxford Companion that you authored, you also talk about cheeses that come from maybe less well-known areas of the world, at least less well-known to the West, right?
Right. And so I was part of an organization called the Worldwide Traditional Cheese Association. And so we reached out to our colleagues. I should say there were 325 authors from around the world that contributed to this book. And several were from Iran, one of the places where cheese originated. And it was just so rich to read the authentic history of how some of these cheeses came to be.
And so tell us more about Iranian cheese.
Well, Motal Paniri is one, probably the oldest cheese on the planet. And it was interesting. I had to edit all of the entries. And I remember this one distinctly when it came in because it's a goat or sheepskin cheese. And typically when you're using skin as a vessel to help in cheese making, it's devoid of hair. But in the case of some Iranian cheeses, the hair is actually on the inside of the vessel where the milk goes and produces cheese. And I thought, well, that's very interesting.
Huh. What does it taste like?
Probably a lot like feta. It's that type of, you know, white brined cheese style.
Oh, fantastic. Now, I have to ask you, I'm curious, we're living in an age where, whether by choice or by virtue of dietary restriction, a lot of people don't eat conventional, you know, milk-based cheeses. There are different cheese substitutes. I mean, what do you think about some of those, let's say some of the vegan cheeses that are out there?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot. And I have to say the Oxford Companion to Cheese really focused on our traditional definition of cheese, which is made from milk. That's a lacteal secretion from lactating mammals. And so we're very dairy-based in this book. but there are, you know, plant-based materials where, you know, when you think about cheese making, what you're trying to manipulate, you're after the protein basis of milk, the caseins and other proteins. In a plant-based product, you would be after the plant protein. So similar strategies, but for me, cheese is definitely milk associated.
Well, that's Catherine Donnelly. She's author of the James Beard Award-winning book, The Oxford Companion to Cheese. Catherine Donnelly, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
It was such a pleasure, and enjoy your cheeses.
I will. Well, that's it for today. I do have four fine varieties of cheese in front of me, so I'm going to dig into them. We'll see you all later. This is Radio Boston.